Welcome to the Black Sparrow Media Internet Broadcast Network.
You're listening to Linux in the Ham Shack. LHS is a podcast about Linux, open source and amateur radio for everyone. Now here are your hosts, Russ, K5TUX, Cheryl, W5MOO, and Bill, NE4RD.
Well, hello everybody and welcome. You have tuned in to episode number 244 of Linux in the Ham Shack. And, things have been a little crazy around here, as anyone who listens regularly will know. Bill had to do an episode solo, which he got through and survived, so he's still here, right?
Woohoo!
Let the lunatics run the asylum, right?
Yeah, well, that's right. And they didn't burn it down, so that's good. And Cheryl's still here?
I think I survived anyway.
All right, good deal. Yep. So we're all back, and we're looking at doing a couple of minor tweaks to the show format, which don't know that we'll talk about tonight, but we'll get to that in a little bit, one way or the other, whether it's an announcement on the website or whether we talk about it here. But tonight is our long topic or deep dive episode, and interestingly, and in a sort of meta way, our deep dive topic tonight is Linux in the Ham Shack, not using Linux in the Ham Shack, but the actual product Linux in the Ham Shack, our ISO that we put out. The Ubuntu distribution that bears our name. Bill's going to talk about how that came to be and how you could do something similar. And then I'm going to jump in after that, I think, and talk a little bit about how we're going to distribute that using torrents and maybe do a little bit of a shallower dive into torrenting in general. So, Bill, take it away.
Awesome. Awesome. So we've got a lot of feedback about the builds, and including a very recent one from Tony, a listener, KM4HSD. He was sending me some emails the other day while I was out and about, and he was saying he was installing the latest, was wondering where the distros were and whether they worked. And I was like, well, yeah, they work. They're the 1804. I haven't revved them up to the .1 yet, which I promised to do 2 weeks ago, and I haven't quite done it. And when I did go to do it, I ran into some issues, and so I've kind of tweaked my build script a little bit, and I figured it was a good time to probably share all that with you. And I know I've talked about the tool I actually use to do this, but we'll start with that first. Basically, I start with my Ubuntu system that I'm already running, and I download the latest ISO from Ubuntu, whether that be Kubuntu, Lubuntu, or any of the other ones. I just built Kubuntu just before we started recording this, just to test everything out and make sure all the tweaks were working as expected, and it looks like everything works, so this is good. So the tool I've been using is called Kubic, and it's a custom Ubuntu ISO creator, so it's a fancy name, Kubic, C-U-B-I-C. And it's a GUI wizard that's used to create a custom bootable Ubuntu Live CD images. Kubic features an integrated command line chroot environment to make customizations and permits effortless navigation backward and forward through the ISO generation steps. This can create new customization projects or modify existing ones. Important parameters are automatically populated with intelligent defaults to simplify the customization process. So basically, this is a tool that makes making ISOs, bootable ISOs, dead, simple, stupid. And I looked at doing the steps manually, and I kind of went through it at one point, and I said, man, this is a pain in the butt. I don't want to do this. And I ran into like either a Reddit thread or something like that pointed me to Kubic. So I've downloaded that, and obviously we were off to the races after that, because it was dead, simple, simple. So in order to install Kubic, you do need to go and grab the PPA release of Kubic from Launchpad, and we have provided the link in the show notes, and you want the actual release, not the beta. I mean, you could try beta, but I haven't built anything with the beta. So you do add that PPA, do your apt update, apt install Kubic, and it installs all the tools you need, and then you get a nice little menu option for Kubic. So you have your ISO that you downloaded from Ubuntu. You have this product called Cubic, and you just start Cubic, and it automatically asks you for a super user password because it is going to run as root. Scary, 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 scary. And the custom Ubuntu ISO creator comes up, a little pop-up screen here, and wants you to set up a directory. I've been just popping these into my documents folder and creating a directory after the build I'm doing. So I'm just going to go ahead and make one right now, lhsv1-xubuntu.
So this Cubic takes off from your current running system, or do you have to have like a clean install?
No, current running system. So whatever you have, doesn't matter what it is. And once you've selected your directory, it basically asks you to select your original ISO. So I'm just going to go ahead and go grab my downloaded ISO, Xubuntu 18.04.1 desktop, 64-bit. And once you have the original ISO selected, it allows you to customize the actual name. So in our version, I've just been putting LHS V1 because it makes the ISO name really pretty. So it simplifies typing in a version number and everything else. And we're just going to keep V1 until I decide to change that. But you can customize everything else, including the release name, if you want something special there, the label on the disk, volume ID, anything else. I just leave all that the same. I just changed the version to LHS V1. And it goes to the next step. It copies the ISO from the drive to a temp space, and then it extracts the compressed Linux file system so it can mount it. And it's doing this all automagically as I'm talking to you right now. And instantly, you're ported into a nice little true-rooted environment where you can do everything you need to do to, add packages, make settings changes, anything else, all from the command line. You're not presented with a GUI or anything else like that, so you're not going to get a GUI in that environment. I don't know if you can even do that, but it's not needed for what you're actually doing. And I built this really cool script. It's not really cool. It's just really simple. And I'm looking for it right now because
simple is the new cool.
Simple is the new cool, and there it is. LHS1v1-builds.sh. It's a shell script, and if you're lucky enough to be listening to this live, I'm actually going to post it into the Discord, but we'll also have it included in the show notes so you can see that, so you can follow along at home. And all you do is actually just drop this script into the window that the chroot environment is, and it allows you to copy it to the system, which is really cool, because if you want to copy files like, let's say, backdrops or anything else like that, you can actually just copy it directly to the chrooted installation, and it just puts it right there on the root for you. So my build script is there, so I just basically make it executable with the chmod plus X.
So if you wanted to, for example, like overwrite the default desktop background, you could just copy one into the spot where it resides.
Absolutely. Or if you had like extra backdrops that you wanted to include, like let's say like some of the other ones that I made, which are really crappy, but whatever. Yeah, you could just drop it in there. Any of the default stuff you can actually change in the environment if you poke into it. My script basically only messes around with the packages. And it's really simple, and this may kill my bandwidth, so I might not do it. So let's talk a little bit about the build script that actually runs out there. Let me open it up with my editor, Vim, of course. No, just kidding. Code. And basically, it's just a shell script that runs through. It does an apt update and an apt upgrade, and I put all the Y flags in it, so you don't have to sit there and hit yes every stupid time. Taking a puff of my cigar here. Hold on.
Well, good. I can ask you a question real quick then while you're thinking. So being that this is called the custom Ubuntu base image creator or whatever it was you said the Cubic stands for, so this will only work with Ubuntu?
I believe it actually will work with some other ones. I have not tested it. But I would say that it's specifically made for Ubuntu installer, so let's not get too creative. And I wouldn't be trying Mint on this. You could probably try something that's built with Ubuntu as a base. It probably would work.
I'm thinking since Mint has its own repos, you could probably just do Cubic with a base Ubuntu install and include the Mint repos, and that would probably work.
Well, that's possible. Yeah, you could always customize it even further. I mean, you could even install like, you know, Pantheon from elementary and stuff like that if you really wanted to get crazy and build your own little custom system. But, you know, the more customizations you do, obviously the more possibility you can break things. So I try to keep it simple. That's why I don't really mess around too much with the environment that that I download. So if it's Kubuntu, I leave it, you know, standard, whatever the KDE that they ship with it. I don't mess around with that at all. Just basically run an update and upgrade. So it'll be slightly newer than the .1 release, because if they've included any kernel changes and stuff like that, this will go ahead and upgrade those. Like this one did this morning. I just, or just a little bit earlier, it upgraded to 4.150 whatever. just like you would if you had a running system right now. So that's the nice part about this. You can actually build something and kind of rev it up at the same time. So I run the update, the upgrade. I add a bunch of PPAs just so it's even more scary. We add the OOK2 CQR, which is the CQR log PPA. We add the GPredict PPA, straight from the GPredict team, so you can get the latest version there. Then I add the four PPAs recommended by GX or GQRX, which is the SDR application. So adds the repos for GNU Radio, the drivers, and the Blade RF. So you get all the cool little neat little tools that go along with GQRX and all the supporting libraries you need for those devices that can plug into that environment. And then we also added the KI7MT WSJTX, the mainline repo, which I think they've finally fixed. So so you can actually install the most recent version, the most recent general release version, I should say. So it's not the what I had on there before, which is the WSJTX-next repo, which would which I think last time I checked was, what, 191RC3 or something like that. So it was a little dated, and I was hoping they would finally update the other PPA, and of course they did. So this should avoid you having to go out and get do the libreadline hack and download the dev from the website. So once you add those PPAs, it has the TACY flag on it as well, so you don't have to sit there and wait and hit OK and stuff like that. It just kind of pops through. And then it runs the apt install for GQRX, SDR, WSJTX, and then all the ham radio pure blend stuff. And that includes the antenna, the Morse, the ham radio, the SDR, the data modes, non-amateur tasks, digital voice, packet modes, tools, logging, rig control, training, maintenance guide, and satellite. And I did run into some issues with this. So I've added three new lines to this script. And I will say that this script you could use on any Ubuntu system. That, like, if you just want to download whatever, let's say you want an Ubuntu Budgie or something like that, if you just download it, you can run this on your system and it'll do the same thing. It'll just install everything the same way. Now, you might not need the next three lines, because this is kind of an issue when you're in a two-rooted environment. Somehow, some way, MySQL Server does not install properly, and you end up throwing a bunch of errors at the end of the install from the dev package manager. So I had added three new lines that basically purges MySQL SQL or MySQL Server from your install in the two root environment, and then installs it separately, and then installs CQR log separately, and then everything is happy. So at that point, you have the entire system updated and all the packages added, and including all the devs are actually downloaded onto the environment. So it will be on the CD. Excuse me, one sec. So your ISO will grow quite a bit. The Kubuntu one went from 1.9 gig to 2.6 gig when I did all this, because it is about 318 or so packages that get added to the system to do this. Now, since, you know, most ISOs, people never actually put them on a drive, or they go on a thumb drive, or if they're using a virtual machine, obviously just load the ISO up. It doesn't really matter the size. I mean, the size can just continue to grow and it'll be fine. But they are quite large. The images get quite large. So once you're done adding all the packages, you basically hit next, because, you know, it's just a little wizard, and it goes through the process of actually compressing the file image and writing out the file image, and it writes out the MD5 as well. So when you're done, it finishes everything up, and then it asks, of course, if you want to delete stuff, and I never do, because you can just go back in and reopen the project, which is a really nice feature, and make changes from your last set of changes. So you basically can continue to upgrade the exact same version for basically until things start breaking. And I did, like I say, I ran into a problem on the 1804, and I thought it was just my issue that the size was growing too big. And when I downloaded the 1804 ones, it basically was the same thing. So it was like not really an issue. I thought it was just because I started with 1804 as the base for the original builds. So with that, it's done. At that point, you have your live drive, your live ISO images ready to go. All those packages should be installed and should be running. And when you click the install button, it should then again install all those packages and onto your system that you click the installer to. So it simplifies pretty much everything with getting all that stuff on there. All the PPAs are actually added to the system as well. So you'll have all those links when you do an apt update and apt upgrade and stuff like that. It'll go ahead and hit those PPAs as a source and a sources list. And it's done. I mean, the Cubic is so dead simple. Anybody could do it. And now I've kind of simplified it to just basically I just run the build script and then wait for it to compress the file system image, and it's done. So yeah, super, super, super easy.
Have you installed the ISO as it's built directly out of the Chroot environment into like a VM just to see it come up before writing it to a drive and then doing it?
I mean, I've done that. I haven't done that with the build I just did earlier because I didn't have time, but I did with all the other ones. I tested them to make sure they'd boot and that everything would load up. And like I said, I think when I did the original build, I said I had some kind of quirkiness with a couple of them with the visuals on VMware. But when I booted the image from a thumb drive on a system, it worked fine.
All right, very good. So which ones have you built for the latest version?
I just finished
Kubuntu.
Or
is that just
and,
the first one?
Like I say, I have Xubuntu here for the XFCE peoples. That's here. And I will eventually click the next button after we're done recording the podcast and stuff. And I'll just let it do its own thing. So it basically runs automated at that point. But it downloads, you know, a ton.
Yeah. All right. That's very cool. I've always wondered because I just remember we've been talking about doing this for a long time. And I think you were kind of fighting through the process and trying to figure out how you're going to get it done and find the time. And obviously you stumbled upon this tool and all of a sudden, bam, yeah. It's like the next day we have distros.
Yeah. I mean, once you get to it, it's amazing how quick and easy it is. And then making the build script makes it even easier. And then you can also use the build script separately. Like if you just want to, you know, like I say, do your own system, you don't have to even bother downloading the ISO. You can just grab whichever build you want from whichever flavor. If you want like Ubuntu Studio or something like that, you could do that and then just run the build script right on top of it. And you don't have to run the build script. You can just look at it and say, okay, I want this and, you know, cherry pick the stuff out of there. But, you know, the build script does make it kind of easy to install those packages. And if it does any quirky stuff, like the ones that I've been noticing here in this environment, it sort of takes care of that problem as well.
And it also does allow us to put out something that's a finished product. So if somebody doesn't want to get into any part of this build process, you just have to
open up the command line and, you know, type in all that stuff or cut and paste or, you know, chmod the build script on your system and then execute it and, you know, cross your fingers that I didn't put some hacky stuff in there or something like that. Although it's pretty straightforward. It just runs commands. There's not even any any coding in there. I don't inspect anything. The build script should actually work fine on pretty much any architecture too, as long as there's support for it. I think most of the ones that I added there have ARM support. So you should even be able to run this on like your Ubuntu install on your Raspberry Pis and stuff, or like Odroid, like I have mine on the Odroid.
Do you have LHS build on the Odroid?
It's not bad.
How's it perform?
It plays like an Odroid running Ubuntu. It's ARM. It's not like great. If you get a lot of things running, it does have issues. I mean, we ran it at the Hamvention on the big TV. And that seemed to work okay. But yeah, you can't run multiple things. And like, yeah, when you ran, you had that LibreOffice presentation with a bunch of extra stuff in it, like animations and stuff, it kind of flaked out on that. It just doesn't have a tremendous amount of power to run those things. I mean, it is an ARM device. It's not, you know, it hasn't taken over the world yet. Oh, yeah.
Right. It's definitely getting there. But it's getting there. Yep. FT8 on your ARM processor. Yeah, it's going to be the way of the world. That's the only way we're going
to communicate. And then you just automate it and you never have to touch the box and you'll just walk out with a WAS and a worked all continents and everything else. And then you'll go find a new hobby and just let your radios run themselves. terrible.
That's kind of the way it seems like it's going. Yeah.
No. So yeah, I mean, we just want to make it easier for people to get on here and get through these steps pretty quick and painless. And you know, the easier it is for people to get introduced to Linux on their computer with everything they need, you know, all the ham radio stuff that they can play with and try. I think it's a great benefit.
Yep, absolutely. And so leading on from that, one of the things we had talked about is once these distributions have been built for the latest version of Ubuntu, and probably any future versions of Ubuntu as they come out, we're going to be offering these as torrents, because that is one of the fastest ways to download data. And so I think we may have dived a little bit into torrenting in the past, but I figured this might be a nice topic for people who've heard the term torrenting, or maybe use it from the perspective of they go to a client and they download a software package or something using a torrent, but they don't really know how it works per se. So we can talk a little bit about the architecture of BitTorrent and what we're going to be using it for, and how you can help us by distributing these distributions through the torrent network. So let's talk a little bit about BitTorrent itself. The way BitTorrent works, it's a distributed architecture. So there's no client-server relationship. It's basically an entirely client-client relationship. So when you download something from BitTorrent, you are connecting to a bunch of different other clients that have either all of or part of the software that you're trying to get, and you download bits and pieces of it in a certain chunk size, basically. And all of those bits and pieces come to you from different locations. They're all put onto your machine. They're cryptographically hashed, and then they're all reassembled into the original product. So, in other words, if you have an ISO image, for example, the one that Bill has built, and you distribute that into the BitTorrent network, then there might be 5 or 10 or 100 or 1,000 other clients out there that have a copy, either in full or in part, of that ISO. And your client will go out and find those other clients and download the bits and pieces and assemble them all back together into the original thing. And because it's so distributed, it offers a fair degree of anonymity, because there's no centralized server where all the data resides. And it's really fast, because you can download pretty much to the extent of your bandwidth, because even though a certain client may only be serving a certain upload speed, if you're downloading from 40 of those, then you can get it as fast as you can possibly pull data into your network. So there's a couple of key features to the way torrenting works. And one of the major ones is what's called a tracker. And a tracker is a, for lack of a better word, it's a server. It's basically just a software application that runs on a machine somewhere. And what it does is it literally keeps track of things. That's why it's called a tracker. Every torrent, when you create one, because you have to create a torrent. So, for example, I'm going to take the Ubuntu ISO image that Bill has built, and I'm going to create a torrent of it. And the torrent is going to be simply that ISO. And when you create the torrent, what you're doing basically is you're creating a hash of the information that's in the torrent and a link to the actual data. And then you publish that to a tracker. And what the tracker does is it keeps track of all the clients who have knowledge of the software that you are torrenting and how much of it that client has. And your client will keep the tracker updated with its progress. So like if you have 100% of the file, your client will announce to the tracker that your client has 100% of the file. And another client may say, well, I'm in the process of leeching this file. I don't have all of it yet. I only have 33%. And then as it keeps downloading and downloading and downloading, it'll keep updating the tracker. So the tracker is sort of the clearinghouse of information on all of the clients and all of the status of the software contained on those clients that are being announced to the tracker. So that's the sort of clearinghouse of information. That's a very important bit. Now, there are lots and lots and lots of trackers out there. There are public trackers and there are private trackers. And the public trackers are the ones where anybody can announce to them and they keep the data updated and anybody can query them for that data. And then there are private trackers. And those are the ones that everyone talks about because those are often ones that have illicit data in them. If you've ever heard of the Pirate Bay, that is a private tracker. So some trackers are searchable. They have a searchable index. The Pirate Bay is one of those. There's like RARBG. There's, I don't know. There's a million of them anyway. But the technology of torrenting is not inherently illicit, but of course it's used for illicit purposes, but it's also used for legitimate purposes, which is one of the purposes we're going to be using it for, to distribute legitimate legal software. So in order to do that, I actually have a public tracker set up on the Black Sparrow Media Network. And I've also used a couple of other public trackers to announce to. The problem with this is these trackers don't have searchable indexes. So you can't go to them and say, find me, you know, the Linux in the Ham Shack 2012 archive, because they're not searchable. The tracker is only to keep the clients in sync when you actually start a download. So that being the case, what you have to do is you have to actually get the torrent file, which is the metadata file. And those are going to be published on the Linux in the Ham Shack website. In fact, they already are. The problem with the ones that are currently there is they're just archives of the episodes. They don't currently contain the ISO image. So that's something that's going to be added. So once that's done, the torrent metadata files are going to be hosted there. And all you have to do is download that metadata file and run it inside of a torrent client. So one of the, my torrent client of choice is Transmission. It's called Transmission BT, or just Transmission. It's cross-platform, it's open source, and the nice thing about it is it has a web GUI, so it's very easy to, you know, manage your torrents in it. So if you want to download a torrent, all you have to do is get the metadata file. It's usually called a .torrent file. You run it in Transmission, and it will simply go out and find all of the clients out in the world that have announced to the trackers that they have a copy of the ISO image, and it will download it for you. And what you'll wind up with is a directory that ultimately has the completed ISO as soon as it's possible to download it completely. But the problem is, since everything's in this distributed network, you have to have at least one client that has a full copy. And there will always be one client that has a full copy. It will be mine, because I'm the one who's going to initially see the torrent. But if you have some cycles on a machine somewhere that can run 24/7, what we would like to be able to have you do is seed the torrent for us or along with us, because the more clients out there that download the torrent, download the data, and announce back to the tracker that they have a completed copy, the more places that other clients can get that from. And that means A, they'll be able to download it faster, and B, they'll be able to use fewer of every individual's resources, because we'll be downloading parts from many different clients. So the more people we can get to seed it, the faster and more available it will become. Now, there's a great Linux-based, I think it's Linux-only, but it might not be. That's another open-source project called rTorrent, literally the letter R and then torrent, which you can run on a server. It has a CLI interface, and it will take a torrent file and download it just like Transmission will, but then you can just leave it in a screen session or something running in the background, and it will continue to seed that file, you know, forever and ever. And if you have a server and some bandwidth that allows you to do this, where people can upload from you, that's what we're hoping folks will do for us. And this is, of course, once I get everything published again. So with our torrent, you have a lot of different options. You can use it like Transmission to download other things. And of course, you can seed from it anything you want to be able to offer up into the torrent network. It also allows you to arbitrarily limit upload and download speed. So let's say, you know, your pipe is only so big. and you only want to allow 5 megabit per second upload for anybody who's getting data from your client, you can do that. So that's a useful thing about RTorrent. And it's also, it also has an XML RPC interface that runs on port 5000, I think, 5000 or 5050, whatever. And then there are some GUI front ends that also interface with RTorrent. So if you want to have a GUI or a web-based GUI for RTorrent, you can do that. I think there are several of them out there, and they talk to RTorrent on the back end using XML RPC. So that's pretty handy. And then for me, the project I'm using to actually keep track of the data is OpenTracker. So if you really get into this torrenting thing and you want to have your own tracker, whether it be private or public, you can use OpenTracker to do that. And then you can use it to announce all the files on your, you know, torrent server, for lack of a better word. And then you can just distribute the torrent files to other people if you want them to be able to download things from you or seed things so that other people can get them as well. So did I sort of cover the idea of how the torrent network works?
That sounds really good.
Does that help? So?
Yeah, it's very, very detailed. More than I've ever messed with. I mean, I've used transmission to download some distros and stuff like that, and I've kept it up for a little while and seeded for a little while, but generally I'll let it get to like at least half or maybe 100% where I've seeded it, I've put out as much as I've taken, and then I'll kill it.
right, and that's what a lot of people do, and a lot of people don't seed at all. They'll just download till they get what they want, and then they'll stop seeding immediately. And with things like transmission and RTorrent both, you can tell it that you want to seed back to the network up to a certain ratio or up to a certain byte count. So you can say, okay, I've downloaded this, I want to seed back 100 megabits or 100 megabytes of data, or I want to seed back like twice the data that I downloaded. So, and once it meets that criteria, it will stop seeding automatically. Or you can just simply stop seeding, you know, immediately if you so choose. But in the scheme of share and share alike, that's sort of like being a dick, basically. if you just download the file and don't seed it, yes, you're being a dick. So don't be a dick.
Don't be me. No, just kidding. No, I always shoot for like 50% or 100%. I mean, I at least give back what I've taken.
Right. Well, that's better than most people do. Yeah. So that's okay.
Sometimes I forget and I leave it running forever.
Now, I understand that a lot of people don't want to seed back to the networks because, you know, what they're downloading is illegal sometimes. Yeah. And so that would be a perfectly good reason, I guess, to not seed it back to the network, because it can be traced if someone gets a hold of the tracker information. However, in our case, all of the data is completely legit, so there's no reason you can't seed it. So, again, if you want to use RTorrent, I wouldn't recommend using transmission to seed back, because it's too GUI based. It's more for your downloading, you know, portion of things. I would highly recommend using RTorrent or something else. You know, don't use your Lime wires or your transmissions or your, you know, anything like that for doing seeding with. If you're able to seed back to the network and keep things running 24/7, use something like RTorrent. In a screen session or something where you can kind of push it into the background and just allow it to sit there on the network and serve clients as they request the data, because it definitely is what makes the whole BitTorrent network work. And once all the torrents are recreated on my end and available, I will have the information you can download from the website. It'll also be in the show notes, so you can just get the torrent files. And any client will be able to seed them. And then I'm also going to include some basic commands using transmission and RTorrent for creating a torrent if you want to seed your own data. It's really, really simple. It's probably just more detailed than we need to go into right now.
Well, it is a deep dive episode.
It is true.
We're allowed to go a little deeper than normal.
Well, it's actually simpler than I'm making it, and I can go through the process using transmission real quick. If you have a torrent, let's say you have an ISO of your own that you want to seed, there's only a couple of bits of information you have to have. One is the thing you want to seed, i.e. the ISO file, and you have to have a tracker to announce it to. Because if you don't announce it to a tracker, there's no way for anyone to download it, because the tracker keeps all the meta information. And that's how it knows where to connect to get the data that you're trying to download. So you have to have a tracker. Now, again, there's lists of public trackers. I'll probably post a link or two in the show notes to publicly available trackers. You can, of course, use OpenTracker to make your own if you want, or you can use one of the publicly available ones. And if you don't want to look for my list, you can just go onto Google and search for, you know, public torrent trackers, and you'll find more than you ever need. And what's important is the announcement URL. It'll be, usually it'll be something like UDP:// you know, mytracker.something:6969/announce. And the important part is the announce bit, because that's where your client is going to connect to the tracker at that URL and announce to it the state of the torrents on your client. So that's the really important thing. So if you have the transmission package installed on your Linux box, if you've apt-get install transmission, then you will have a utility called transmission-create. And so all you have to do is go to your ISO file. I would probably put it in a place where you can keep it and not lose it, because you do have to have the original data. And then, let me get the syntax here exactly so I don't mess this up. Transmission create. Okay, so you've got your ISO file in a directory somewhere where you can keep it, and then you type transmission-create --o, the name of your torrent file, like myiso.torrent, and then -c and a comment, and you can make the comment anything you want, like I made this, or something more informative. And then you can do -t, and in -t, you put the URL of the announce, i.e. UDP:// mytracker.org:6969/announce. And you can have multiple -t's. You can announce to as many public trackers or private trackers, if you're a member of them, as you like. And that just allows more people to have access to that data. So you can have one or two or 50, doesn't matter. And then you just put what you are putting into the torrent, i.e. the ISO file. So you just type the name of the ISO file. You can also do multiple files. You can do directories, multiple directories. You can have torrents that are many, many, many gigabytes in size if you want. Doesn't matter. The metadata file that's created by this command, transmission-create, will be relatively small, a few kilobytes maybe, maybe a megabyte or two, depending on how much metadata there is. But there won't be a whole lot. So then what you do is you take that torrent file and you put it somewhere where people can get it, or you send it to people or whatever. Just the torrent file, not the rest of it. And then when they put that torrent file, load it into their client, their transmission or rTorrent or LimeWire or whatever it is they're using, it will contact the tracker, find out where the data is, immediately start downloading. And when 100% of the data has been downloaded from wherever it can be downloaded from, you'll have a copy of it. And if you leave that copy in your transmission or LimeWire or whatever client, then it will start seeding back to the network. It will announce back to the tracker that you have 100% of the data. And then other people who start to download the file can get it from the original source and now from you. And then as the next copy is created, there are three sources. As the next one's created, then there are four. And as long as those continue to seed, everybody who gets the file later on will be able to get it more distributed and quicker. So that's how it works, and that's why it works.
Cool.
All right.
That's awesome.
Well, hopefully that was at least interesting, because it wasn't really entertaining. I know that. Because I was listening to myself talk, like, wow, this is dry as hell. I mean, it's interesting to me because I like the way torrenting works, but...
Yeah. Do you torrent the episodes at all or no?
Do I what the episodes?
Torrent the episodes.
I do. What I do is like I archive them by year. So there's a torrent for 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011 that has all of the episodes that were recorded during that calendar year. Awesome. And you can download them, you know, each by torrent. And the link to the torrent files is on the website. Those are actually on the website, right?
Sweet.
The only problem is I'm having a problem with my tracker right now. So that's why I'm going to have to redo all the torrents. So, but I will redo all the torrents. They'll be published. They'll be mentioned somewhere, i.e. show notes on the website, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so if you have some bandwidth and some cycles to kill, you know, feel free to download those torrents and keep a copy of those files handy so other people can download them as well. And there is also a complete archive. At the end of every year, I do an archive of every episode that's recorded up to that point. So you can get every episode in one torrent, and pretty soon you'll be able to get the ISO.
Nice.
All right. Well, I think I've spoken way much too much about torrenting. But hopefully that was interesting to somebody. And now, since Cheryl's not paying attention,
we can bring her to sleep over there. She's in a coma.
Well, now we have feedback.
Awesome.
We have like actual feedback, so Cheryl can read feedback. There's only two of them, so you can do them both.
Wow. Oh, we do have a question real quick.
A question. Excellent. Yeah. I love questions.
Yeah. Can torrents be updated, or do you have to make a new one?
My understanding, I have not found a way to update a torrent. What you do is you recreate the torrent and republish it. So if someone knows of a way to actually change an extant torrent, I would love to know how to do it. But as far as I know, you can't. Because the metadata file contains the hash of the data that's in the torrent. And if you change what's in the torrent, then the hash changes. And the torrent itself is just a flat file. So if you change the torrent file, you've changed everything. So basically updating it would create a new thing.
So yeah, it'd probably retire one if we do
like an update. Yes, that's exactly what you would do. You would retire it and have to redownload it. Now, the nice thing about it is the cryptographs stay the same. So let's say I updated the torrent file. The torrent file would be brand new, but the only thing that changed was one episode. Okay. As long as you kept the original data, it would recognize that you already had most of the torrent already downloaded and just download the new bit.
Ah, well, that's cool.
Yeah. But you would have to get the new torrent file. But like I said, as long as the original data didn't change, it would only download what was different. It would be like a delta.
Yeah, so that reminds me, like when you get out of transmission, when you exit or stop a torrent or delete the torrent file, make sure you don't delete the data.
Yeah, don't delete the data.
It does ask you, do you want to delete the data too?
Yes.
You hit no.
So yeah, you can't update the metadata file, but you can save yourself some time as long as you keep the data around.
Yeah. Cool. Now I think we're ready for announcements and feedback.
All right. So Cheryl, announcements and feedback.
Woo. All right. So the first one is a comment on episode 241 from Dave, KF7JAF. And he says, social media roundup is in the show notes. You needn't bore us with reading it out loud every single podcast. Sheesh.
It's different every time though.
it is different. So
well, like with the torrents, some of it is the same and some of it is different. So
But it's in the show notes.
It is in the show notes, but I would say to this two things. These are the two things that I thought when I read this originally. One is we save this to the very end of the show. So if you stop listening right before the social media roundup, you won't miss anything else. So you don't have to listen to us read it. And number two is the reason we read it is because I like giving everybody the recognition. So that's kind of the whole point.
And it puts me out of a job.
Yeah. I gotta have something for Cheryl to read. Come on, jeez.
You're reading feedback. So you know.
Well, yeah, this is like the first time I've read feedback in forever.
Is this like a hidden agenda from Dave? He just wants to get rid of Cheryl.
Well, that's okay.
That may be. We don't know. Can't see into David's mind.
So. No, Dave, no, don't do it.
Well, I would just say that we will continue to read the social media roundup just because every week it is different. I mean, the Patreons and the subscribers don't change a whole lot, but everything else does.
Occasionally they change.
Occasionally, that. Right. And it's our way of recognizing those people on air who support the show, and I think that's important. So
yes.
So point taken, but we're still going to do it.
So. Suck it up.
Just skip the end. Yeah, but you don't want to hear it. Just skip
exactly.
It.
Exactly. So, but yeah. Thanks for writing in, Dave. We hope you continue to listen despite the social media roundup. So, yeah. All right. What's the next?
All right. The next one is a comment on episode 239. From K5PDC. Because I also caught Poland and Bulgaria, Idaho and Maryland, and two Brits. It's fun when it works on 20 meters. I did it, fellas. I finally made not one, but three SO50 contacts and my POTA activation at K0334 in Maryland. I worked my 90-degree wrist twist KK4YEL was helpful and patient. The other HF and VHF contacts were fun, but to finally make 5 watts VHF on an FT2DR into space was exhilarating. Cheers, fellows. K5PDC, Pete.
All right, very good. I don't know if that was in response to a weekender challenge about getting people to work satellites or probably not, but I would like to think it was.
Yeah.
Whether it is or not, so I'm going to take credit for that. But fantastic using a handheld, presumably circularly polarized antenna to make contacts on SO50. That's very cool. That's way more into it than I got. I didn't take my own advice or my own challenge yet.
You never do. You never have time.
I would like to. I really would.
Can step outside his Uber and work a pass real quick.
Yeah,
I could. I mean, Neil did that when he was up in Springfield. He kept running out to the car from his hotel room to make satellite contacts. So, yeah, it can be done. Sure can. That being said, we do need to recognize those folks who popped into the chat room tonight and listened to us live, and those are, that we know of at least, Jim, VE5EV, Ted, WA0EIR, and Pete. New Pete, as far as I know. I don't recall seeing this call sign before. Kilo 7 Papa Tango Romeo. Thanks for stopping in tonight. And Pete, thanks for coming by and actually asking a question. That was cool.
Yeah.
Other people ask questions.
No, that's true. Sometimes they do. But when people are in the chat room like for a long time, they seem to get complacent and they just listen.
And sometimes they just shoot the breeze. So.
Well, and there is that too. Yeah, that's always fun. But with that, I think we're going to go ahead and wrap this one up. Thanks to everybody who listened to us live, who participated in the chat room, and for everybody who listens to this afterwards. We really appreciate you guys. That's it. It's been episode number 244 of Linux in the Ham Shack. I'm Russ, K5TUX.
I'm Cheryl, W5MOO.
And I'm Bill, NE4RD73.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Linux in the Ham Shack. LHS is a community-sponsored podcast. Our website is located at lhspodcast.info. You can support the program by visiting the LHS Patreon page of patreon.com/LHSpodcast or using the contribute link on the website. Get in touch via social media. The show has a presence on Google+, Facebook, Twitter, Discord, and YouTube. Or you can drop an email to info@lhspodcast.info or record a voicemail at 1-909-LHS-SHOW. That's 1-909-547-7469. Visit the IRC channel, LHS Podcast, on the Freenode IRC network. Also visit the online merchandise store at shop.lhspodcast.info for fun and fashionable LHS merchandise. Become an ambassador and represent LHS at a Linux convention or hamfest. Email ambassadors@lhspodcast.info or visit the website for details. The podcast is recorded live every Monday night at 8 o'clock p.m. Central Time. Connect to the stream at stream.blacksparrowmedia.net/8008/LHS live. Until next time, over and out.
in the Ham Shack and the Linux in the Ham Shack logo are released under a Creative Commons Attribute Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License.